Hi there, Shan Chi here, Executive Director at Byron Writers Festival. And you're listening to the Deep Dives podcast series recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. This session, titled The Book of Roads and Kingdoms, is an immersive conversation between Richard Feidler and Kari Gislason.
Hello. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special deep dive into the world and the mind of Richard Feidler and his latest book, which is called The Book of Roads and Kingdoms. My name is Kari Gislason. I'm a writer and an academic, and I am here to discover a little bit more about the world, the golden age of Islam, and also to hear more from Richard about history, imagining the past and how we bridge that gap between us and other cultures and other periods. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Arakwal people of the Bundjalung Nation, the traditional owners of the lands where we meet, and also acknowledge that this has always been a place of storytelling and imagination. Does Richard Feidler need an introduction? Richard is well known for his interviews on ABC Radio. He is the author of the best-selling Ghost Empire, A History of the Lost Civilization of Byzantium, and he is the co-author of Sagaland.
Yes.
Undoubtedly his standout work to date, because it was co-written with me. He is also the author of The Golden Maze, A Biography of Prague, and his latest book is the one that we'll be discussing today, the beautiful, magical and extraordinary work, The Book of Roads and Kingdoms. Welcome, Richard Feidler.
Thank you very much.
How lovely to see a full tent of people here to listen to stories of Islam and stories of the Golden Age. And so perhaps we need to begin there, Richard, with just hearing what the Golden Age was. What does it mean to speak of a Golden Age of Islam?
The sudden arrival of Islam into the world constitutes one of the greatest shocks in all of world history. The Romans, and in the later Roman Empire, otherwise known as Byzantium, and the Persians in late antiquity, would often refer to the Arabs as a very marginal people living on the fringes of an arid peninsula that they wanted nothing to do with, pretty much. It was uninteresting to them whatsoever. And then suddenly, in the 7th and 8th centuries, in no time at all, the Arabs came charging out of the Arabian Peninsula, fired with a new religion and ideology of Islam, and in an incredibly short period of time, took half the Roman Empire from the Romans. They took Egypt, Palestine, and Syria, and in no time at all, Egypt, which had been a province of the Roman Empire since the time of Augustus and Cleopatra and Mark Antony, gone forever. They took Palestine and Syria, the Holy Land of the Christians and the Jews, and then they took all of Sasanid Persia. They took all of Mesopotamia, and then they went into the Iranian plateau and beyond into Central Asia and to the Indus Valley. So in no time at all, they had an empire that was bigger than the Roman Empire at its peak, which stretched from North Africa to India. This constituted one of the great shocks in world history. Initially, they had their capital in Medina in Arabia. Then the Umayyads, the first dynasty, had their capital in Damascus. But then there was a revolution. Another dynasty, the Abbasids, took over, and they created a purpose-built city as their capital, the city of Baghdad, on the Tigris River in the year 750. And this was designed around a circle. It was a purpose-built capital, and it was designed to it was kind of like the Canberra, really, a capital built around a circle. And it was built in the Mesopotamia, on the Tigris, which the caliph at the time knew could sustain a huge population because he wanted a big city, and a big city it became very quickly. Again, in several decades, heads. Baghdad became the biggest and richest city in the world. It was a huge event. And very quickly, it became the major intellectual centre of the world. Even going beyond, it could be said, Chang'an or Xi'an, which was the Chinese capital of the time. It was a city of people who were mad about books, mad about travel, and mad about books about travel. And they created these giant compendiums of travel accounts of the greater world because they felt they were like the British in the 19th century and the Americans in the 20th. They felt they had everything right. They had the best ideas, the best religion, the best ideology, the best technology, the best legal system, the most culture, the most learning. They were the best at everything. And they because of this, because their religion was right, that God had granted them the whole world. And so the next thing what they wanted to do was to go out and see it. And so they compiled these great geographies of the world, which fascinated them. And this was pretty much at the heart of this book, created during the golden age of Islam, at this time when Baghdad was, as I said, the biggest and richest city in the world.
I'm just trying to imagine ancient Canberra at the moment.
Oh, yes. It's still in its very earliest phase, but look out, world.
Were there large roundabouts that you had to navigate? Or?
There was a ring road, a ringed wall at the centre in the original city, which I showed this, the map of medieval Baghdad, to Hugh Rimmonson and Sally Sara, journalists who served in Baghdad during the Iraq War. And they went, oh, yeah, that's where the Green Zone was during the Iraq War, where the Americans created a kind of a little mini Westfield shopping mall right in the middle of downtown Baghdad. But this original round city had the Caliph's Palace in the centre and the Great Mosque of Baghdad.
So what was the secret to this expansion? Can you explain to us why they were so successful? Because usually when civilizations expand, they've worked something out that other people haven't worked out yet.
One of the things was they picked their moments. They emerged at a time, Islam emerged, the Prophet Muhammad appeared, gave them their religion, gave them the words of the Quran, and this appeared at a time when the Eastern Roman Empire, the later Roman Empire based around Constantinople, had been in a death-like struggle with the Sassanid Persians, who were based in Mesopotamia, for 20 years. And it had left both of them, it had left the Romans victorious, but both sides completely drained and worn out. And this had come after years of the bubonic plague as well. So after the Prophet Muhammad died, the first of his successors, Abu Bakr, the first caliph, which means successor or deputy, he thought, well, I've got to keep my people together, keep the tribes unified, so we'll have some border raids to get a bit of money. So they did some border raids to the north on the Persian and Roman settlements. When they got there was really no one guarding them. And so quickly these border raids turned into acts of conquest that took them very far and very fast, because both these old empires were run exhausted and broken and poor and run down. And so they were able to conquer very quickly. But they were also able to conquer very successfully. Like, you have Hitler, who takes, you know, half of Russia and half of Europe, and then it's all over and done within 5 years. Napoleon didn't last. The Mongol Empire didn't last very long. So why did Islam last? One of the reasons was they went about their conquest in quite clever way, which was they realized that there were no other Muslims other than them in the places that they conquered. But what they did was they offered people a deal. They offered Christians and Jews in particular a deal. They'd show up and they say, look, the first thing you have to do is acknowledge the caliph as the sovereign of this place. And you're also going to have to pay a special tax on unbelievers called a jizya. But if you do that, then you can have your you can have your church, you can have your synagogue, you will be unmolested, your homes and your people will be left alone, you can serve in our courts, you can do all these things. And people in Egypt and Palestine and Syria and Mesopotamia who'd been dealing with the bastard Romans and Persians for years, and they found these jizya taxes were less onerous than the taxes imposed by them by the old empire. And the fact that Islam was not coercive, it was not coercive in the foundation of this empire, except in a few places in Central Asia, but they were the exception rather than the rule. They did not impose Islam by the sword at all. It was, you pay your tax, you go about your thing, you keep doing your thing by all means. In fact, the caliphs were encouraged to not have people convert to Islam because they relied on the taxes that the unbelievers had to pay. But over time, if you're ambitious, you might want to serve in the higher levels of the government. You had to become a Muslim. And, of course, people were genuinely, some were genuinely inspired to convert to Islam, seeing it as a kind of monotheism 3.0, whereas Judaism is 1.0, Christianity is 2. Islam, they could present as the third and final and best iteration of monotheism. So this is one of the reasons why it lasted and lasted and lasted. The other reason was, as soon as they overran Persia, they brought in all the Persian bureaucrats, the governing classes, who knew how to run a railroad. They were sophisticated, educated Zoroastrians who converted to Islam and ran the empire very, very well. So it was militarily brilliant. It was not coercive religiously, and it was very well managed, which is why it was so successful so quickly and lasted for so long.
The empire you're describing sounds quite pragmatic. It sounds sympathetic to difference. It doesn't want to necessarily change the people that it's ruling. And yet it's also driven by religion, is that right? So the caliphate has a religious goal. How does that kind of work together? Because it's not necessarily how we always see religions and governments working hand in hand.
The caliph was sort of like a pope and an emperor at the same time. Over time, as the Abbasids weakened and their empire weakened, getting into the 10th, 11th, 11th, 12th centuries, their empire shrank and they became less of an emperor, but they still remained absolute figurehead of the religion, the commander of the faithful, as he was called, in amongst the Muslims in the Muslim world. So he was at the absolute apogee of this empire, under the reign of someone like Harun al-Rashid, who'd been known to people who had read the 1001 Nights. He was a real historical figure, a real caliph, one of the most powerful of the Abbasid caliphs. He was a very powerful emperor, but also a supremely powerful spiritual leader as well.
And that religious drive didn't require other people to believe in their faith.
No, it didn't. They had that kind of confidence, that imperial swagger, which said that, well, you can keep doing your thing by all means, but come on, really? They're like, you know, Americans who think that they can just impose whatever they have on the rest of the world because that's what the world really wants. And they were like that as well. This is imperialism. This is what imperial cultures are like.
And were they right? Did people start to convert to Islam as a result of this kind of benign dictatorship? Is that the word? Or
It's hard to sort of use those terms without 20th or modern connotations.
Yeah.
But most empires were run that way. There were very few republics left, or there were some. But yes, it was. It was said that Islam talked its way into the Middle East rather than fought its way into the Middle East, as their armies did for political. Political dominance was achieved by its armies, but Islam talked its way in. And much stress was put on the written word, because Muslims, like Jews and Christians really, were forbidden to make graven images, which is why mosques are so full of beautiful sacred geometry rather than icons. Because when you go to Istanbul, you know, formerly Constantinople, you can go into the Hagia Sophia, or maybe not today, but you used to be able to see these beautiful, stunning mosaics and frescoes in the Hagia Sophia's dome. But the Blue Mosque, which faces it, you don't see any images of people or holy figures, but you do see these stunningly intricate geometric patterns, which sort of feel very holy in a very different way. And there was a great premium on the written word, because for Christians, the great divine miracle is the body of Jesus. Jesus is the thing that comes into this world from the outer spiritual realm and walks amongst us in the diurnal world as this kind of holy miracle. But for Muslims, it's the Quran. That's the unadulterated word of God. And so there's so much stress on text. And so very quickly there was this love of reading, this love of writing. And in Baghdad, there was the creation of this extraordinary library that was known as the Bayt al-Hikmah, which was the House of Wisdom, where scholars would collect, gather books, and translate the ancient wisdom. They particularly revered the wisdom of the ancient Greeks and the ancient Indians, works of philosophy, mathematics, geography, the natural world, and astronomy were all compiled and brought together in this place.
Do we know what life was like in Baghdad during this period? I mean, what kind of a city was it? Was it an orderly place? Was it anything like a modern metropolis?
Yeah, very much so. It was a pretty bawdy place. There's some pretty bawdy stories from Baghdad. I'm hesitant to tell this one, but it's kind of fun. There's a story of like a boatload of merchants going down the Tigris River, going past a palace and seeing these beautiful women hanging out, sort of sunbaking and sort of lounging languorously in the sun. And one of these very rude gentlemen, this market gardener on one of these barges, lifted up his gown to expose his manhood, which was tumescent, I think is the best way of putting it at the time, and he shouted out to them, "Asparagus for sale! Asparagus for sale!" And one of the women was said to have pulled up her dress and said, "Hot buttered bread." So Baghdad is full of really bawdy stories like this. And the Thousand and One Nights.
It's like meeting someone at Coles.
Yeah, that's right. It happens to us all the time in Coles, as you know, yeah. And the Thousand and One Nights, and people have read the Thousand and One Arabian Nights here, I'm sure, encountered it. They're full of such stories. They're fabulous. You get a sense of it being Baghdad as the great metropolis. It was a city for people. They wrote about it with a sense of expectation. Baghdad was the city you could go to encounter the fabulous, the amazing, the weird, the beautiful, the sublime, the grubby, the filthy, all those things at once. It was like the way people wrote about Baghdad then, the way people have written about New York City today.
I mean, I feel as though some of my expectations are being tumbled upside down, because the world you're describing sounds quite permissive and tolerant and open. Are they the right words to use?
Oh, absolutely. It's life in the big city. I mean, all the caliphs of, you know, Muslims are forbidden from drinking alcohol, but the caliphs are all getting on the grog and getting drunk often and saying, "Oh, you know, I'll ask forgiveness in the morning." You know, they're not. It's not Afghanistan under Sharia law. You know, it's not like that. This is a big city. This is where people do things, and they're open to the cosmopolitan pleasures of the capital.
Now, I think you have a reading that describes Baghdad for us, Richard.
Yeah, this is a description of Baghdad in what's commonly regarded as at the height of its golden age under the rulership of Harun al-Rashid, the great caliph in Baghdad, who, as I said, appears quite often in the Thousand and One Nights. When he appears in the Thousand and One Nights, he often appears, we find him in the stories, at the beginning of the story, in his palace, the Palace of Eternity. And it's one of those hot summer nights when it's too hot to sleep, and he says, "I'm bored," to his friends, his courtiers, and says, "Let's go out incognito into Baghdad and just see what we can find." And they go out into the streets of Baghdad incognito, and they encounter a mystery or an adventure or something ghastly, and that's how the stories progress. But the real Harun al-Rashid, according to the histories, the Muslim histories written at the time, seems to have been a moodier character than that, not quite so adventurous, haunted by the necessities of wielding political power, which often required him to have people killed, and in some cases his friends killed. And that was what he felt he needed to do to keep the empire going on an ongoing basis. But he felt, according to the histories, he felt terribly about this and worried he was going to hell for the sins he had to commit to do for the greater good of the empire. But this is a description I've written of Harun al-Rashid in Baghdad at the time of his wedding. Harun al-Rashid, tall, good-looking and slim, with wavy hair and olive skin, presided over an empire that stretched from North Africa to India. The English poet Tennyson would later fantasize about the golden prime of good Harun al-Rashid. And even in Harun's own time, Muslims could feel the sunshine of God's goodwill on their faces. "Did you not see how the sun came out of hiding on Harun's accession and flooded the world with light?" asked one giddy poet. Harun was in all likelihood the wealthiest man who ever lived and spent his riches freely. On his wedding day, he handed out fistfuls of gold and silver coins to people from all over his realm, while his servants distributed brocaded gowns and scented oils from large glass bowls. To his wife Zubaydah, he gave an ornate sleeveless jacket, a badana, studded with oversized rubies and pearls. So great were the splendors and riches of his reign, wrote Masudi. Such was its prosperity that this period has been called the honeymoon. When Harun came to the throne, Baghdad had become the first medieval city to pass the population threshold of 1 million people. In the new districts of Rusafa, Shamasia, and Mukharim on the east bank of the Tigris, princes, courtiers, and merchants built palaces and mansions that outshone the grandeur of the Golden Gate Palace in the Round City. While in Baghdad, Harun preferred to dwell in the Casa al-Kuld, the Palace of Eternity, overlooking the Tigris and so famed for its gardens, which were said to rival those in paradise. Here the caliph could find some respite from the heat of the day and the pressures of court life, sitting in the shaded pavilions of an immense flowered pleasure garden, surrounded by waterfalls and trees, with precious gems studded into their trunks. The palace interiors facing the gardens had been decorated to subtly correspond with the colours blooming outside. One visitor later recalled entering an audience hall carpeted with pink fabric and attended by servants in matching pink silks, which looked out over the treetops of a garden that had burst into leaf with roses and peach and apple blossoms. Here you go. Thank you.
I have to say, Richard, it sounds better than Canberra.
Yeah. Although Floriade, the flower festival, yeah, Baghdad, yeah.
No disrespect to Canberra, of course. Just a little bit of a side note, I suppose, I'm interested in personally is the reading that people did at that time. What sort of books were in the library that inspired or entertained or informed the caliphate?
All sorts of things happened at the same time to make Baghdad the world's great centre of learning at the time. The first thing was the invention of a new kind of Arabic calligraphy, which was more flowing, like cursive, which made it quicker and easier to copy books, because they all had to be copied by hand in those days. The second thing was the introduction of Indian numbers, the numbers we use today, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, which we call Arabic numbers because they were introduced to Europe from the Arabic world, but they were brought in from India. And with the introduction of these numbers, suddenly this whole new world opened to them intellectually in mathematics, astronomy, and even bookkeeping. As anyone who's tried to divide MCXV111 into equal portions of LXV will instantly understand. So that was the second thing. And the third thing was the introduction of Chinese papermaking technology, which was thought to have occurred around about the one time that the Abbasid Empire went to war with Tang Dynasty China, where the Abbasids emerged totally victorious. There was a story that said these Chinese prisoners of war were brought to Baghdad and taught people papermaking technology. It was almost certainly more complex than that, but that's kind of a nice story. And with paper, there's another revolution. Previously, people had been using papyrus, which is easy to scrub the text off so you could forge documents, or they'd use parchment made from animal skins, which the sagas, the Icelandic sagas, were written, as you say, which is incredibly expensive and difficult to make. But the introduction of cheap, mass-produced paper was like a miracle. The first thing it did was that it can take the ink as you write on it, so it's harder to forge documents. It's a pleasure to write on paper. And it has all this tensile strength to it. Like, you can bend it like this. And they found that with paper, you could get a sheaf, which is an Arabic word, of paper, stack it together, bind it on one side, and suddenly you have a codex, which is like a normal book, which is so much easier and more compact than a scroll and so much easier to find information in. So you have all these things happening at the same time, and suddenly Baghdad becomes a city of books. A whole section of the city is given over to booksellers and bookmakers. And believe it or not, one of the most highly paid professions in medieval Baghdad was of, two most highly paid professions were poet and translator, not hedge fund manager. this is what the importance of book meant. And a fine example of this was they were absolutely dedicated to gathering, like I said, the wisdom of the ancient Greeks and ancient Indians. The caliph, one of the caliphs, was reading Ptolemy, the ancient Greek scientist, and discovered that Ptolemy had estimated the circumference of the Earth to be, and I think the figure is around 24,000 miles. And the caliph read this and went, "How did he do that? Did he get someone to walk around the whole girth of the planets? You know, get some. How did he do that?" So he called in three of his best mathematicians, which were three brothers, the Banu Musa, and said, "See if you can actually prove Ptolemy's theory." And so this is what they did. They went out into the desert. They put a peg in the ground, and they had a bit of rope behind it, and then they went towards the polar star, and they kept it with their astronomical instruments in sight, and they waited until it fell in the sky by 1 degree. They measured the distance from the stake to where they were, then they measured the distance when it would drop going by 1 degree, going the other way. The distance was the same. You multiply that distance by 360 degrees and you get the exact same figure of just over 24,000 miles, which is within like 4% of the absolute correct figure. Now, think of what that means to do that, to measure the circumference of the Earth. If the old Bedouin culture that they came from, they were cameleers, they rode through the desert, and the Earth for them was this great disc before them. But as soon as you start imagining the circumference of the Earth, where is your mind's eye right now? It's in space. Think of what a kind of a quantum leap intellectually that is. In your mind's eye, you're somewhere perhaps on the moon, looking at the Earth as this globe from space that's just over 24,000 miles in circumference.
The debt we owe then to this culture is immense, just in what you've described there and what we're doing here today in storytelling and books. I suppose when you have a city that is as rich and wondrous as the one you've described, you might be tempted to stay there and to enjoy the riches that you've created. But this was a culture that sought to extend beyond what it knew into unknown territory. Why is that? Why was this culture fascinated with the world beyond its borders?
They went beyond the borders for several reasons. One was sheer curiosity, of course. The second one was on diplomatic missions to receive the submission from lesser kings in the world beyond, or deal with the emperor in Constantinople, who was pretty much the only figure that ever gave them, made them nervous, because Constantinople was really the only city that they knew of outside of China, which was too far away, that really could rival it in beauty. And the emperor was a similarly powerful figure, and they kind of spooked each other a bit. They weren't quite sure about how to deal with each other, because they were kind of a threat to their both empires' idea of absolute global supremacy. Some of them went as soldiers. Some of them went on special missions from the caliph, and a great many of them were merchants and traders who followed the Silk Roads, coursing from Rome, to begin with, Constantinople, really. Up through the Middle East, up through Central Asia, and down into China. And also the maritime Silk Roads. Basra was built as a port city, and Kufa on the Persian Gulf as well, whereby merchant ships went out of that part of the world, down the coast of Africa, through India, down to Sri Lanka, which was known as the island of Serendip, which is where we get the word serendipity from, and from there down to the Spice Islands in Southeast Asia and up to China. So it was for all those different reasons. And because it was important to know what you were going to find on the road, they wrote these, they came back, and they were often asked, "Tell me what you saw, how far you travelled, where can people stop, are there Muslims there, can we worship, how do we do this, how do we do that, to get there and get back safely home?" And a whole lot of it, of course, based on sheer curiosity. And I felt that kind of lovely sense of curiosity about the foreign people that these travellers met on the road.
So what are some of the texts that come from this time, these travellers' accounts that you mention? Are they well-known works?
No, they're not. Not in the Western world, and maybe not anywhere really these days. They all have beautiful names. I took the name of this book from one of them. The Book of Roads and Kingdoms was written by the Caliph's head of their postal service, the Barid, the best postal service in the world at the time. He was also being the head of the postal service, kind of like the head of his secret police as well. He wrote this, compiled this, Ibn Quradhibi, his name was, he compiled this book called The Book of Roads and Kingdoms, traveler stories that reached out to the world beyond so that people might have, treat them like, a lonely planet guide, if you like, as they went out on the road. There was Al-Masudi, my favourite of all the travellers, who wrote this extraordinary work. It's a beautiful book. It's still never been fully translated into English, and it's called Meadows of Gold and Mines of Gems. Isn't that a beautiful title for a book? Isn't that wonderful? There were books at the time called, like, Tales of the Marvelous, News of the Strange. I mean, don't you want to read that? The Book of Gifts and Rarities. It gives you a sense of the joy they took in what they found and what they saw in the world. And not unlike the medieval Christians of the time, the medieval Muslim scientists and travellers saw the world as this infinitely complex, beautiful puzzle that was created by God. And God had also, by the same token, endowed us all with reason to figure out his workings. So this means that if you're a scientist, everything about the world that you discover is you're looking at the hidden hand of God behind everything. And that gave them such great pleasure and joy in the world.
You've arranged your study around the compass, the four compass points. And these were also a mirror of the gates to Baghdad.
Yeah.
Maybe we could follow those compass points a little bit, Richard, and you could tell us some of the things that our travellers found in these treasured kingdoms that they visited. Even the Vikings make an appearance, don't they, in this
book? Vikings barge in, Icelanders in particular, like yourself, Curry. Barge into every single one of my books. It's not like I go, oh, let's go looking for where the Vikings are at. They just go, they barge in like Lenny and Squiggy and Laverne and Shirley, sort of fairly through the front door going, hello, we're here. So Vikings...
I wasn't actually invited to give this interview today. It was meant to be a solo thing for Richard.
I started with begins with the West chapter, and it's not really an Arab account, this story. It's the account of the astonished courtiers of Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor, the first such person as to receive the title in the year 800, who made his own purpose-built capital in a spa town, Aachen, which is on the border of modern-day Germany and France today. And he saw himself as this great emperor of Western Europe. In between, there was the later Roman Empire, or Byzantium, as we call it today, and beyond that, there was the Caliphate of Harun al-Rashid. And he was forever trying to find a partnership with one or the other. He proposed marriage to the Empress Irene in Constantinople, who is one of the great forgotten figures of world history. The Empress Irene is a hell of a figure. And in Constantinople, they went, there is no way you're marrying Empress that bogan in Aachen, okay? These are people who live in filthy backwaters. It's rainy and cold. They've all got disease. They have no libraries. They don't even have proper roads. You know, no, that's out of the question. So Charlemagne was appalled by this and tried to reach over Byzantium's head and made contact with Harun al-Rashid in Baghdad. And they were sort of interested, and they sent out this caravan. They sent out two caravans. The first caravan they sent out astonished the court in Aachen. They wrote, the courtiers like Alcuin, and not Alcuin, but these other courtiers, wrote accounts of this extraordinary caravan that arrived, which was laden with incredible silks, beautiful tents, precious oils, and the first great present, though, that astonished them, that was part of this first caravan, was an elephant called Abul Abbas. And they'd never seen a bloody elephant before. And we know this is true because you can see in some of the Illuminated manuscripts at the time, they start drawing realistic drawings of elephants, which would have to assume was modelled on them sighting Abul Abbas. Then a second caravan arrives, and another great wagon loads of incredible treasures and presents. And amongst these presents is a mechanical water clock, a device of such sophistication and complexity that Charlemagne's courtiers thought it was necromancy. They couldn't figure out how it worked. It was that good. But the puzzling thing about this story of this Western embassy out of Baghdad to Aachen, to Germany, is there's no record of it in Baghdad. We have these voluminous records of trade delegations, of this and that, goings on in the court, no mention of this whatsoever. And it's sometimes thought the reason is that, that little kingdom out there, it was just too minor for them to even really pay that much attention to. It wasn't worth recording. That's one theory about why it rates no mention. So that sort of gives an image of how it was seen, the might and prestige of Baghdad was perceived from as far away as France and Germany. The second chapter is East, and this is the mightiest story, I think, in my whole book, and I'll just skate over it very briefly here. This is the tale of a traveller called Salam the Interpreter. His journey east came about when the caliph at the time, Al-Watik, had a nightmare. He had a nightmare one night where he dreamed that the wall of Gog and Magog, that was said to exist far to the badlands of the world in the east, had crumbled. And it was known that the wall of Gog and Magog that had been built in ancient times by Alexander the Great was holding back this vile, vast race of monsters. These incredibly obscene and cruel and grotesque monsters, apocalypse beasts. And it was said in the Quran, it's also said in the Bible, that when the wall falls, these apocalypse beasts will race across the holy land, holy cities of the world, and that will bring on the apocalypse, the end of the world. So the caliph was greatly disturbed by this. So he sent Salam and a bunch of other diplomats, soldiers, to go out east, find the wall of Gog and Magog and report on whether it was intact. Now, he went out, he saw something that looked a lot like what he saw in the Quran, and came back and gave a report that goes into the original Book of Roads and Kingdoms. Now, for a long while, it was thought this was just some kind of Arabic wonder tale. You know, can we really find a giant wall between two mountains that is made of iron bricks where there are all these monsters behind it? But then his Dutch translator in the 19th century and others picked up the thread and drew a kind of an itinerary that you can follow all the way up past the Caspian Sea, arriving at Kashgar, the westernmost city in China, skirting around the Taklamakan Desert and arriving at what is and was the westernmost stretches of the Great Wall of China. Wow. So that's the second story. The third story is the south. That's the story of those mariners I mentioned on the maritime Silk Roads. They got on their boats and ships and went trading, travelling all the way down the east coast of Africa, where there were small Muslim kingdoms along the coast, going down beyond Zanzibar, down as far as Zimbabwe, and going the other way out of the Persian Gulf, down around India, Sri Lanka, Spice Islands, and up to the port city of Guangzhou, where there was a whole quarter of the city devoted to Arab trade, where Muslims had their own judges within this quarter. And I have lots of different stories about the fantastic lands. For the Arabs, India was this fantastical land where they projected all their great fantasy creatures. This is where we hear all those like tales of Sinbad come from, where India is seen as this place. I don't think they ever saw India very straight. The reports on India are always too fantastical, except in one or two quite important cases. But they're always a place of giant birds that take you off to a nest somewhere, or people that are half fish, half human. But they're really cool tales. They're really entertaining to read. And then they wrote accounts of China, which are some of the most accurate, earliest accounts, foreign accounts we have of Chinese cities. The North story, that's the grimmest. And it's the story that got me into the book in the first place. It's the account of a diplomat, an Arab diplomat named Ibn Fadlan, who was charged as part of a diplomatic party out of Baghdad in the early 9th century to go up north into modern-day Russia on the Volga River to make a treaty with a Turkic king living along the Volga there. It's a complicated story, but he went there. I loved Ibn Fadlan because he was such an inner-city cafe latte-drinking ponce. used to life in the comforts of the big city, and he's suddenly out in the bad lands of the world, where it's a bit like Wake and Fright, where he has to rely on the hospitality of nomadic Turkic peoples who give him everything, and he just bitches and moans about the whole time, like, they're unclean, they don't practice proper Islam, and he's kind of ungrateful for all the things they give him. It's, you know... But when he arrives there, it's all going very well, but then it goes wrong because the money that was promised to this king doesn't arrive, and so he's held hostage. And he has something like a nervous breakdown. And around about this time, while he's staying there, he has an enforced stay there, a party of Vikings arrive. This is when the Vikings arrive. These are fur traders travelling down the Volga River. And they set up camp. And at first, Ibn Fadlan says, oh, my God, these are the most beautiful people I've ever seen in my life. They're tall, they've got russet hair and green eyes, and they wear amazing clothes and have beautiful jewellery. Day two, he says, these are the most disgusting people I've ever met in my life. They fornicate and defecate right out in the open. When they... he talks about how unclean they are, and he goes, bitches and moans and goes on and on.
I think you're describing before the drink and after the drink.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, because he says the first thing that the senior men did for their ablutions in the morning was a slave girl would pass around a wooden bowl of water. The chieftain would eject the contents of his nose into the bowl of water, dip his comb into it, comb his hair, have a good drink from it, and then pass it to the next guy who did exactly the same thing.
And, so, what are you saying about that?
What I'm saying, Kari, is a bit like being in a British family, being the youngest member of the family on bath night, weekly bath night. You don't want to be the guy at the end of the line there, do you? And then, while he's there, the chieftain dies, and the senior men come to the slaves, and they say, which of you would like to die alongside your master? And according to Ibn Fadlan, the whole tone of his report changes. It becomes much colder and more factual. He said, a young woman puts her hand up. For 2 days, she becomes like the bride of the dead chieftain, and she's made a fuss over, and she prepares for her death. And they prepare the body, they prepare the chieftain's longboat, they set up a tent inside the longboat with cushions, they lay his body out there. And there's this weird moment. And if anyone has seen that movie, The Viking, The Northman, that came out recently, this is replicated in that movie. She's put in front of a door frame, and she's lifted up by her feet. Ibn Fadlan reports all this. Lifted up by her feet to look over the doorframe, and she says, oh, I can see my ancestors in Valhalla. Second time they lift her up, she says, I can see my mother and father in the afterlife. The third time she says, I can see my master in Valhalla, and he's calling me. And then they lift her down, and she says, take me to him. The funeral, the scene that unfolds of her sacrifice is one of the most... hair-raising things I've ever read in my life. It's the most extraordinary document I've ever read from the Middle Ages. I won't go into the details because they are so harrowing, but it's a rite that's so heavily impregnated with blood and sex and magic and death. Her death comes at the hand of two Vikings men and a shamanistic witch woman called the Angel of Death. And I read this and I thought at the time that anyone who took part or witnessed this awful ceremony went right out to the furthest realms of human existence. So that I think is the most powerful document of all the travelled stories I've found from the Muslim world.
Did they find their limits? I'm thinking of, for example, Hadrian's Wall in England, where the Roman Empire made a decision that it had reached the limits of its expansion and that it was time to consolidate. Did something like that happen yes. In this case?
Yes, twice. The first limit they reached was under the Umayyads when they tried to invade Constantinople. They had two cracks at it, both ended disastrously and catastrophically. Even on the way back from their failed siege of Constantinople in modern-day Istanbul, as what was left of the Arab forces on the flotilla, as it was going through the eastern Mediterranean, there was a volcanic eruption, and just about the rest of the navy was burnt to death by volcanic ashes. This is recorded in the Arab histories, their own histories about this. And, of course, when things like that happen, both the Christians and Muslims of the medieval world, you think, we've earned God's disfavour. What have we done to earn God's disfavour like that? So they hit the limits their entry into Europe with the walls of Constantinople, the most powerful city walls in the world. Constantinople was the kind of the bulwark, if you like, that allowed Christianity to stabilise and flourish in Europe. To the east, they only ran out of steam there when the land stopped being arable. They got into Central Europe, and when the land got bad, they went, oh, I can't be bothered going any further because who wants that land? So there was really very little to stop them at all. They invaded India successfully several times, but decided in the end it was just too far from Baghdad, I think. Really, it just the distances became insane. So that was really the only thing in the end that stopped where they met their limits as an empire.
One of the fascinating moments in your book is when an envoy to China, meets... Is it the Emperor of China?
The Emperor of China, yes.
Can you read us that moment in the book?
This comes from a book written at the time called Accounts of China and India by a sailor and a merchant called Abu Zaid. And he compiled this book, writing in the Persian city of Siraf, as, like I said, like a merchant's guide, a seaman's guide to how you get between here and China. And it's really funny because, like I said, some of the accounts of India and China were pretty fanciful. So in his introduction, Abu Zaid says, look, you're not going to get any of that bullshit here. This is just going to be factual, okay? None of these fancy tales. We're going to give you factual stuff. But he does write this account, the travel account of a man named Ibn Wahb, and I call this chapter The Travels of Ibn Wahb the Aristocrat. In 871, a man named Ibn Wahb decided to leave his home city of Basra, which had fallen into violent chaos. This was the Zanj Rebellion, an African slave rebellion that went on in the fields around Basra. And he sailed off to China to pay a visit to the emperor. Ibn Wahb was an Arab aristocrat, a descendant of the prophet, who naturally expected the emperor would grant an audience to such a distinguished guest. Sailing out of the Persian Gulf, the summer monsoon carried Ibn Wahb's boat down the west coast of India to Sri Lanka. Then after passing through the Straits of Malacca, Ibn Wahb tacked north, sailing up the coast of Indochina to arrive at the flourishing Chinese port of Guangzhou, a city the Muslims called Kanfu. From there, Ibn Wahb travelled inland to Chang'an, the Chinese capital. This is the city we now know as Xi'an today. In the 9th century, Chang'an was a great metropolis, rivaling Baghdad and Constantinople in population size. The capital was divided by a broad, tree-lined avenue running from north to south. The western side, where most of the inhabitants lived, was filled with markets, houses, and manufacturing centres. The eastern side, the imperial district, was dominated by the emperor's palace and the mansions of his high officials. Ibn Wahb found lodgings near the palace gate, which he approached each day to request an audience with the emperor. Eventually, his petitions reached the emperor's courtiers, who arranged for Ibn Wahb to be accommodated in a comfortable guest house inside the palace grounds, where he stayed until the courtiers could confirm with the governor of Guangzhou, who kept detailed records of foreign visitors, that Ibn Wahb was indeed, as he claimed, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad and a man held in good standing. And with that assurance, Ibn Wahb was granted his audience. The Tang Emperor, Yizhong, was reputed to be lethargic and fond of strong drink, but Ibn Wahb found him alert and curious. How was it, the emperor asked him, that the Arabs had managed to bring down the empire of the Persians? With the help of Almighty God, Ibn Wahb replied. The Persians fell because they worshipped fire and bowed to pray to the sun and the moon. According to Ibn Wahb's account, the emperor readily acknowledged that the Arabs had indeed established the most magnificent empire. They are the richest, most intelligent people in the world, the emperor said generously. Their greatness is known to everyone. Then the emperor asked Ibn Wahb, how are the kings of the world ranked by you Arabs? The question surprised Ibn Wahb, and not knowing how to answer without causing offence, he said he had no idea. The emperor then said this, we count 5 kings as great. There is the ruler of the Romans, whom we call the king of men, because there are no other people on the earth who are more beautiful. And above him is the ruler of the Indians, whom we call the king of wisdom, because wisdom originates with his people. Then above him is our neighbor, the ruler of the Turks, whom we call the king of beasts. Then above him is the ruler of this land, by which he meant himself, who was known as the king of his people, because no other king is more revered by his people. But above all these kings, admitted the emperor, is the ruler of Baghdad. He is the greatest, for he is at the center of the world, and all other kings are ranged around him. We call him the king of kings. All the rest are beneath him in rank. At the conclusion of their enjoyable conversation, Ibn Wahb said that on return to Iraq, he would speak highly of China and its emperor. I shall recount what I have witnessed of your majesty, he said, and the extent of your country. I will have nothing but good things to say. The emperor was very pleased to hear this. He arranged for Ibn Wahb to be presented with fine gifts and to be given every luxury for the duration of his stay in China. Now, the thing that historians love about this account is that undoubtedly, Ibn Wahb did go to China. We don't doubt that. Whether any Chinese emperor in the history of the world would ever admit an emperor greater than him seems unlikely. But who knows? We don't know. This was his account of the thing. It's possible. It's possible Ibn Wahb misheard. It's possible the translator said something that was pleasing to Ibn Wahb rather. But nonetheless, it's kind of a fun account that paints a picture of Chang'an or Xi'an at the height of its glory. Thank you.
Richard, I thought perhaps for the last part of our conversation today, we could talk a little bit about you as a writer and how this book sits alongside the other three titles that you've written. And maybe to begin with, thinking about this book in particular, you range quite widely. You know, as I'm reading the book, I marvel at your ability.
Thank you. Just said. Otherwise, we're going to be, you know, harsh looks and coffee after this, wouldn't it? Attempt, you say, sir? Attempt? How dare you, sir?
I think the first round's on me this evening. Your ability to draw the strands together and to move across countries and between time periods, and it feels to me as though there is a link between your work on radio and the way that you write, which is this ability to curate and shape stories and to bring different elements together. Do you have a principle of selection? Is there something in your mind that allows you to do this collecting and curating of stories?
When it comes to writing, I rely on a process that, and this is going to sound childish, perhaps, or stupid, but I think of it it's kind of a bit like magical thinking. It's the only way I can put it. I sort of put myself in places where I think I'm going to be interested, and I just wait there for a while. When I wait there, I mean, I'm reading, of course. I'm reading. But it feels like waiting, and it never works to run hard at something. You don't go, oh, there's some, go, like, and charge up, because then the story skitters away from you like a frightened deer or something. It's better just to stand quite still and wait for the story to come up and sniff your hand. I know that sounds really odd, but that's how it feels to write these stories, just to be patient with it and meet it on its own terms as much as you can. I really want to avoid the sin of presentism at all costs, the idea, that awful habit of projecting the values of the modern day onto people in times gone past. It's the height of arrogance to me. It says, oh, they were so dumb then and we're so much smarter now. We now are more enlightened human beings. But people living 1,000 years ago were no stupider or cleverer than we are now. They were just as we are, terrified individuals existing on a strange planet with limited information. So I like to try and meet them on their own terms, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. That's my approach, and not try and let my own... I think my enthusiasm and curiosity is really important, but I try not to let it get in the way of just sitting down and shutting up and listening as hard as I can to the voices there. A large part of that is listening to voices of women. Women are often written out of medieval history. This one was hard in particular because the culture, such as it was, this is a very patriarchal era, but no empire was probably more patriarchal than the Abbasid Empire. They made the decision to sequester their most talented and most brilliant women in a city of women, the harem. And they do come onto the stage at times. Quite often there is queen mothers, powerful queen mothers walk onto the stage. But the really interesting women of the time that I found were the slave singers. When they came on, I was listening as hard as I could for their stories because you can sometimes hear the songs they create, often spontaneously, and hear them in their own voices as a result of that. But again, that process, you really need to listen carefully to listen for the women. But once you do, the women come forward. Oh, they come forward, all right. Yeah.
And isn't it funny how the process you describe is similar, I think, to how many storytellers talk about composition, which is that it's a combination of searching but then being prepared to follow as well.
Yes.
You know, and that it's when the characters start to take over almost that you know that the story is actually working in its own way.
Oh, completely. And the way into my book, as I said, was the story of Ibn Fadlan going up into Russia to meet the and his encounter with the Vikings. And I, at the time, I remember I had another idea for a book I was going to write, and I couldn't write it because I had to travel to this place, and then we couldn't travel because of COVID. And so I thought, read about travellers. So I found, I thought, I'll look at the Vikings again in the East, maybe follow them. And then I found Ibn Fadlan's account. And following him, following his story as he leaves Baghdad, I had that kind of that delicious feeling you get. It's like, what the hell's going to happen now? Where's he going now? And as things get worse and worse for him, he suffers the most awful, harrowing cold. There are moments of high comedy, which I don't really even know he's conscious of. Like he stays with one Turkic tribe who, again, show him every hospitality, somewhere on the Ustyurt Plateau. Incredibly bleak landscape. Horrible place, really. Just kind of gravel and dirt. Not much else besides. He's taken into the yurt of a local man there who's sitting there with his wife, and he's given food to eat, which he can sort of choke down. And as he's talking to the chieftain, this senior man, he says, this guy's wife just kind of opens up the folds of her dress, exposing her pudenda to him, and just starts scratching at it. Like that. And he said, all I could do, he's writing about this in his account, and he says, all I could do was bury my face in my hands and say, God forgive me, God forgive me, God forgive me, God forgive me. And the husband goes, ah, he kind of laughing at the prissy Ibn Fadlan. He goes, yeah, look, you know, yeah, in your Baghdad, you've got all these women who are all very hoity-toity, but, you know, our women will do this stuff, but you cannot touch them. Whereas in Baghdad, anyone can sleep with your women. We all know this. So don't even think about it, buddy. So I'm reading the stories, and he's writing about it so earnestly, and you sort of burst out laughing. And then it goes into this, one of the darkest places I've ever been to in all of these historical accounts, the sacrifice of this poor girl. And it seems she volunteered for it, and maybe you can see why she volunteered for it. If you think a bit about, I mean, her life as a slave girl would have been awful, just terrible. So this is her way of living as a kind of an honoured bride for a couple of days before she ascends into Valhalla. I mean, I don't know. We just don't know. But yes, this delicious sense I had of Ibn Fadlan taking me to these places I'd never been before, showing me these extraordinary things on his journey was fabulous and so enjoyable. I enjoyed writing this book. I enjoyed the research so much.
And I suppose that feeling of strangeness is a joyful one for writers and readers alike. We want to be taken somewhere, you know, beyond ourselves. And I guess my last question then about this writing process and to connect it to the theme of the festival is the role of your imagination in that. I mean, you ground your work in research and you are committed to accuracy. Are you also committed to some imaginative act that goes alongside the empirical one?
When I wrote my first book, Ghost Empire, which was a history of Constantinople as the Second Rome from its inception by the Emperor Constantine to its fall by the Ottoman, its successful invasion of the Ottoman Turks in the 15th century. I used to go to bed at night while I was writing that. I had these wonderful maps and descriptions of the city, and I used to imagine myself as a pilgrim entering the city through its land walls, through the Theodosian walls, these legendary double walls that kept the city inviolate for 1,000 years. And I used to imagine going through the Golden Gate, which I've seen and been to, which is this kind of wasteland now in Istanbul, going through the Golden Gate, following its main road, the Mezza, all the way down past colonnaded shops. I used to do this lying in bed, just in my mind, travelling in my mind down this street, arriving at the Augustaeum, the main square, where the Hagia Sophia was and is, the Hippodrome was, well, what's left of it is there now, and imagining the great palace of the Caesars just below, which wasn't so hard to do because when I went there with my son in 2014, we stayed in a hotel that was on the grounds of the great palace of the Caesars, and its basement wall was one of the walls of the palace. And I used to do that night after night as a way of lulling myself to sleep. And I did the same thing here with Imperial Baghdad, imagining myself entering the city, going past its slave markets, going into the round city, going beyond to the gates of the Tigris, going up to the Shamsiyah Gate. I would do this night after night as a way of, I don't know, trying to summon forth, using my imagination to just kind of summon the presence of the city itself, its concrete reality, even though nothing exists of it today in my mind.
Well, I think it would be lovely to finish with a final reading. Richard, is there something you can give us to conclude the session?
Yeah, I mentioned my favourite of my travellers was a man named Masudi, who is a towering figure who should be better known all over the world. I loved reading his book, Meadows of Gold and Mines of Gems. It's, like I say, it's never been translated completely. The most recent translation was done in 1989, a wonderful translation. And Masudi wrote, in that book, he kind of has the whole world in it. The story of the places he visited in Africa, China, etc., etc., but also histories of the courts of the caliphs, and full of, it's gossipy as well, and funny and charming and super interesting. But the most fun thing I read of his wasn't in Meadows of Gold and Mines of Gems. It was in a letter that was discovered he'd written to a friend. And it was a letter where he said to his friend, "Do you know, I've just discovered this potion for invisibility." And this is how I've presented what he wrote. "This is how you become invisible. Anyone can do this. First, you must find a dead cat. The animal must have already died from old age or from some misadventure. You must not slaughter one for this purpose. Carefully remove the dead cat's head and hollow out its eyes. Then take it to a patch of ground in a place where no one is likely to visit. Dig a hole. The hole should be deep as the distance from your elbow to your fingertips. Put some dung at the bottom, then place the cat's head inside the pit so it faces up to the sky. Now you must do this. In both eye sockets, place a castor oil seed. Then fill the rest of the hole with dung, pat it down, sprinkle a handful of fine dirt around the edges in a circle, and place a round stone on top. No one must see you do this. Then every day for the next 30 days, you must irrigate the site with blood. Now, this should be procured from a blood letter. Again, no creature should be harmed. If, after 40 days, there is a shoot from the soil, good. If not, continue watering it with blood for 60 days. If it sprouts, good. If not, then continue watering it in this manner for 70 days. If not, then for 90 days. Tell no one of this. After a time, one or two plants may grow. When they begin to bear fruit, and this is crucial, you must not let it fall from the tree to the ground. Instead, carefully harvest some seeds from the pods. And this should be done while the moon is waxing and not waning. Then you must climb up to a high place, like a rooftop, and sit there with the seeds in your lap. To your left, there must be a 14-year-old boy on the cusp of puberty. To your right, there must be another 14-year-old boy who is not yet a man. Put one of the seeds in your mouth, then turn to the boy on your left and ask, do you see me? If the boy says yes, then turn to the boy on your right, taking care not to lose your balance, and ask, do you see me? If he also says yes, then throw away the seed and place another in your mouth. Repeat this process with each of the other seeds until you find the one seed that, when placed in your mouth, will make both boys answer, no. they will likely say this with some astonishment. Carefully place this special seed inside a signet ring, concealed under a jewel, and wear the ring on your finger. Then, whenever you wish to avoid someone in the marketplace, put the ring in your mouth and disappear. Many people have done this and succeeded.
Thank you. Everybody, join me in thanking Richard Feidler.
Thank you. And Kari Gustafson. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.